Well, great to have you back with us here at ColdSeek.com Radio. Today's featured guest, Bob Hoy from Institutional Advisors. Well, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the show Bob Hoy. He's advised institutional clients for over three decades as editor and chief investment strategist. Welcome back.
Chris, good to be with you and good to be with your listeners.
It's always a pleasure having you back, and we're glad you can make time for us today. I know you're writing and researching at the desk right now, so maybe that's a great time to talk about an interesting little anecdote here in the precious metals community. I thought we'd start off today. A coin from 1794, you may have read, the first dollar in the United States, actually, silver dollar, that is. This is the first silver dollar ever minted, sold for $4,993,750 in a private collection, and the coin was first owned by a British aristocrat, and it was minted in Philadelphia. So much for the barbarous relic status, huh?
Yes, indeed. Was that at auction?
It was at auction, and $5 million if we round up a few bucks.
The rarity of it.
Doesn't hurt that it's silver, too.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's an interesting segue into what I wanted to talk about today. I found another article here by Koos Jansen. We're talking about the Shanghai Gold Exchange, which, as we all know, is one of these facilitating exchanges, which actually does its intended purpose, and that is ships gold, delivers gold. Well, we just find out that they shipped a record 2,000 tons at the latest reading as China continues to buy heavily, you know, during price smackdowns. And I just like your thoughts on what's going on here and the significance of the Shanghai Exchange.
The demand for gold in uncertain times is appropriate, but I think this is because of its unique liquidity. I think the extreme demand for gold in order to make money out of getting even with the dreadful Federal Reserve System and its depreciation policies, that peaked out in 2011, and it could be a long time before it comes back. So our view is that everyone should own some gold as insurance, and you'll only make money out of it if the currency you live in is going down. And you have the condition in a post-bubble world where the senior currency remains chronically firm against most other currencies and most commodities for most of the time. So this suggests a new paradigm for gold, and actually the new paradigm has been on since 2011. We've been talking about it since then, where eventually the demand for gold's unique liquidity becomes very important, but forget trying to make money out of it in U.S. dollars. And these auctions will be interesting, but that's an exceptionally precious coin. And we continue to look at that. Now, what we have recently here, the U.S. dollar had been weakening since the summer as various parts of the financial world got hit. You had, maybe it was some of the hot money taking itself home and getting out of the S&P or getting out of treasuries or getting out of junk bonds in the U.S. market and then taking the money home. But beginning a couple of days ago, yesterday, there was kind of a reversal during the day and stocks sold off as the dollar firmed up a little. So whether the firming up of the dollar had anything to do with anticipating Mario Draghi's announcement overnight, our time, we don't know. But today is an exceptional day in the stock market, with the Dow being up a little more than 300 points, all on news. And it's been in a rally here. If you don't mind, the Dow is a good one to talk about now because that's the one we were doing the work on, whereby at this point of the declining market, you know, it set its high back in May using the S&P, it became oversold going into October 2nd with that horrible unemployment number. And we understand, of course, that the employment numbers are rigged all to hell, but nonetheless, that was a bad one. And there was a lot of pressure on stocks and low-grade bonds at that moment. And so you'd expect a relief rally once the bad news was out about employment. But then the Federal Reserve and the Treasury stepped in with a lot of repo operations in the Treasury market. And I understand it was the greatest intrusion, even much greater than anything they did in 2008. So you had a natural short covering rebound turned into a horrendous short squeeze. But in using the Dow, we had the upper Keltner band would be the target on the rebound, which was at... Yeah, 17,505 this week, and so far it's virtually there. It's the Dow's at 17,400 and something rather. So, essentially, the rebound likely at this time of year for the Dow has been reached. Getting some pretty good. You're getting some. A very good momentum swing from being exceptionally oversold on August the 24th, Black Monday, to now, getting a little overbought. But what we look at in that momentum thing is the is how far it's traversed from being exceptionally oversold. So let's put it this way: the stock market rallied to a level that has been possible. But it's still vulnerable. You know, there'll be other...
Certainly on the same page with you regarding the U.S. equities situation. I think there was considerable technical damage done, and this rally you're seeing here is just, and we have been experiencing, as some backing and filling. And if we do continue to consolidate under resistance levels, which I'm seeing in virtually all the indices, I suspect we will see continued liquidation. You know, this is the time of year we usually do find a solid footing on the market. But I think that seasonals might be trumped this year.
I was laughing with my colleague earlier today and wondering if, following the disaster on October 2nd, you had the Fed do the repo. Then you had overnight the Eurobank coming out and renewing its vows to be reckless. So that then leaves the Bank of Japan to do something totally bizarre by the end of the month. So I wonder if these interventionist announcements themselves are seasonal. I mean, by now, most central bankers know that you can have financial problems in September and October, which we have been, seeing. But what we used here was not so much the seasonal. Well, we noticed in 2007 that when the senior stock index took out the 50-week moving average, that was the official kind of thing that turned the market down. But then the initial decline in the market, or the intermediate decline in the market, lasted about 4 months. So that then counts out to November. So we have had this kind of count going on where maybe there could be a good low in November, but on the in-between one, we had to have the bounce on the Dow up to 17,500, which we're virtually there. So I think this is clearing the way for another slide. The unemployment number that came out on October 2nd was so bad that, they had to do something. So and that's just not going to be 1 month bad, because there are other things not so good, industrial production numbers, commodities, particularly base metals, remain weak. And crude oil did a nice rally right up to the 200-day moving average. at 50 and weakening, and we've been looking for crude oil can do a seasonal decline down into late December, early January, and copper can do a seasonal decline into November, which we're getting. So we don't see too much stuff around friendly for the stock market other than this rebound that could be getting tired right now. Gold's on that sector, which is one that we like for the longer term. We're looking for stability in the sector. You know, the bear market has been on since 2011. And we're looking for that stability in, like, taking the gold stocks, GDX, and dividing it by the bullion price. And we needed that to be going up, and breaking through the 50-day moving average would be very positive, which it did do a couple of weeks ago. So actually, the moment it popped above the 50-day, that was positive for stocks, and you've had a nice rally across the board. And but again, this you also would want to see further stability in the gold price itself. And we're looking at, this is, I think, a cyclical bottom for the gold sector. And this would be appropriate because we're getting past the cyclical top for the orthodox side of investments, i.e. stocks and junk bonds, if one can say that orthodox investments would include junk bonds. And it did include, to many people's regret, commodities. You know, up until 2011, the big houses were recommending that institutions carry 5 or 6% weighting in commodities. Well, I mean, that's been a disaster. And they didn't seem to realize that one of the features of a post-bubble contraction, and the big bubble was 2007, that had many of the characteristics of 1929 or previous bubbles like 1873. So although what we've had since the crash ended in 2009 has been yet another bubble. Sure, it's the timing similar to the rebound that ended in 1937, but you know that was a very vigorous rebound. And this one rebounded to incredible highs because the Federal Reserve, I mean, the central bankers, they live in an unreal world. It may be logical in their from their perspective, but it doesn't fit with the real world. And so they have this bizarre idea that if they expand credit, it will result in an expansion of business and GDP, which is, in logical terms, is a primitive syllogism. That's just because two things happen at the same time. They happen to be a business expansion goes with a credit expansion, but to say one causes the other is highly dangerous. So what we have is going on is, but it's not been going into GDP, or at least rather weakly. Instead, it's going into stocks and, until last year, low-grade bonds. And they don't see that as inflation. In the central banking mentality, inflation is rising consumer prices. And inflation and financial assets doesn't exist. So they keep going on saying, well, it's safe to be reckless because there's no inflation. And you've had magnificent inflation in junk bond prices, very much over. And you've had fabulous inflation in stock prices. We've been saying, well, it was in July 23rd, noted that the bull market was probably over. And then our July 27th piece came out with, we said that institutional advisors initiates coverage of Wells Fargo Bank. Gosh, it peaked almost about that week, as did the other banks' stocks, the BKX index, and they've come down rather nicely here. So I think that since July, the bull market has been over, and once you had the Shanghai crash down to August 24th, we've had the rebound, and then the next leg down, we've got the target of the low set on August 24th for the senior indexes, and that's now our next objective on that. So then, I know that our listeners are always interested in the precious metals, and we started off with your comment about the first silver dollar minted trading for, what did you say, $5 million. Incredible. So at any rate, silver and gold, there's an interaction between the two that's been on for a few hundred years, and we call it the metallic credit spread. And when you're in a boom, the gold-silver ratio goes down because silver outperforms gold. And when you're in a contraction, it goes the other way, and silver goes down relative to gold, and it turns with the regular credit spreads, like the difference between high-yield bonds and investment-grade bonds, or even prime corporates.
Bob, is this on a weekly or a daily basis?
Most of the time the trends are obvious and run for a few months. But you can see it sometimes intraday when you get some excitement going on. As a matter of fact, one of the telltale warnings on going into a bad financial market is one day suddenly silver could be down 1 or 2% with gold not much changed.
And that's probably due to the industrial demand?
I've been pushing the gold, analyzing the gold-silver ratio since the 70s. And it is astounding that they can trade minute by minute together when you get this going on. That if you're going into financial pressures, as I said, you'll have a day where there was one 2 days ago where all of a sudden silver got whacked relative to gold. And so this then is gold-silver ratio is an important indicator. So whereas you get many people in the precious metal side say that you got to buy the silver, it's the poor man's gold and all that sort of stuff. And then also silver lends itself very well to supply-demand analysis, and there are researchers out there that can tell you almost the last ounce where all the silver is or where all the gold is. But since we've been advising mining companies, which actually goes back to 1976, the main story we have is that you can't make any money out of analyzing supply and demand on any metal, and you're better off to look to see its own behavior patterns within the business cycle or the credit market cycle. And one of the things that about gold and silver is very reliable is that silver will, if it sharply drops relative to gold, like in here over the next few weeks, that would signal another phase of credit concerns. So our view is that when you're going into financial storm, the serious money will position in gold because of the liquidity, and it won't position in silver because it isn't as liquid. I guess that's as simple as you could put it.
Very good. Well, keeping with this precious metals theme, I wonder if you might comment on the head of Tocqueville, John Hathaway's recent comments that he expects this global drain, as he calls it, of precious metals from the Western nations to the Eastern nations to resolve itself with an enormous and catastrophic short squeeze in the markets. Can you put a time frame?
That's intriguing. Thanks for bringing it up because I missed that one. Yeah, it adds a little drama to the view that I have, is that in the next phase of the credit crisis, the investment demand for gold will surge because it is a unique liquidity. The other thing that scared serious money does in a storm, it buys treasury bills in the senior currency, which happens to be still the U.S. dollar. So this is why, I think this is the main explanation of why the T-bill rate and the Fed funds rate is effectively at zero, because of the, you know, people just parking their money there. And people that buy treasury bills and the concern money that positions in gold in anticipation of a storm are not buying, positioning to make money. They're positioning so they, in an item that's so liquid they can get it out when they want to go the other way. And so it's the liquidity that counts. And yeah, I guess one, over time, could see that demand for physical gold and the investment demand continuing to increase, because the way we look at it, and which is the way the financial markets, like back years ago, I sat down and actually by hand calculated the average real price of gold as deflated by the consumer price index, originally in England and then later in beginning of the 1930s in the U.S., and it tells a story, and that is that the price of gold, once the financial mania is over, which was 2007, that its real price goes up for as long as it takes to wash out all of the excesses in the credit market. And that's usually been about 20 or 25 years. So, and then within this, you have the change in the business cycle, where during the business, the upside of the business cycle, where we've been since 2009, orthodox investments are more attractive than gold, which since 2011, that's been confirmed. And then when you're in each of the contraction phases, of course, that's when the real price of gold goes up, where, like, for example, it's very clear now you had the high for crude oil at $107 a year ago in June 2014. And it's been down as low, you know, below 50. And that represents energy cost, and you're operating a mine, you're going to be using a lot of energy, blasting agents, various forms of power, running the equipment, even the cost of tires reflects energy, that sort of stuff. So we're into the phase now where the global economy is weakening, base metal commodity prices are weak, and they're very weak relative to gold. So this, underneath it all, the real price of gold is improving, and that will eventually flow through to a, say, a given operation on a mine that is, say, constant head grades and nothing else changing. So then you have your cost. Then also with depressed conditions in base metals, they've been shutting down base metal mines, and that frees up labor as well, and it also puts a lid on wage costs. So as difficult as it is, each post-bubble deflation has eventually been very good for the gold mining industry. And you even, Chris, you take a look at back on the history of the great gold rushes, 1895, that was a depression bottom. 1840s in California, the depression bottom was 1845. The gold discovery was 1849. And all the way back, the Great Depression bottoms have been associated with gold rushes, and the gold rushes happen because you've had a maybe 15 or 20 year trend of increasing real prices, and then you've also had the trend of higher and higher unemployment in a contraction. So then you've got the number of unemployed men, and a very high real price for gold, and they go out and find it. So, of course, the Depression bottom that ended in the mid-1940s, World War II, was a great distortion, and you did not have a gold rush in that Depression bottom, but maybe the next Depression bottom will be a gold rush. And I'll leave you with looking forward to when the juniors are flying again, and they will at some point really fly.
Well, that's a great way to wrap up today. And if you had to pick one top metric for the turnaround, the nadir, the bottom in the precious metals, let's call it ongoing correction here.
In a deflationary bubble, gold will outperform silver, and it outperforms copper. Or a deflationary contraction, gold outperforms everything. But on the rallies, brief rallies, sure, you're going to have the silver kick in, and silver will rally on brief rallies faster than gold. And, of course, that's what we used to get out back in 2011. We used the RSI, the daily RSI on the silver-gold ratio. And whenever it gets above 78, it shows that the speculation is becoming pretty compulsive. And in 2011, it got up to 92. And we knew that the only time it had ever been there was in January of 1980. So we pointed out that was the case. It was like 1980.
Well, hat tip for that, but Bob, does it work in reverse? Because we've had our top, we need our bottom here.
Oh, yeah, we've been trying to get that, but there's not the equivalent. It was just more like, as I said, we want to have the gold shares outperforming the bullion. And rising above the 50-day moving average. And that happened 3 weeks ago. So this is very positive. It needs to be tested to conclude the bottom for the sector. That would be gold stocks and gold. And then at times, if the big market, like the S&P, is getting hit, gold shares will get hit. But I would say a year from now, gold stocks will be quite a bit higher than they have been recently.
Obviously, the extremes on the downside that we saw in the mining and related shares were just to levels unseen in decades.
Chris, I've been in a number of bear markets for precious metals, and always the one you're in is the worst. But I was talking to one of my buddies my age, he's been in the game as long, mining engineer, very successful in discoveries. And his company has a drilled-off property, good one, and any number of targets, other properties after that, they're ideal. They've also got money. So my friend was telling me last week, he says, we're getting people, good guys, good geologists, with good prospects, coming to us saying, please take it off our hands at any cost. I just can't stand it anymore. I got to get out. Now, he doesn't recall that happening on previous bear market lows. So maybe we can say that this has been the worst one.
Briefly, are there any particular securities, ETFs, that you would be adding to a portfolio right now for our listeners?
Yeah, you could do some shorts on ETFs, on S&P, stuff like that. Bank stocks, yes, definitely bank stocks. And the ETFs for exploration stocks, GDXJ in the States and Ziggy in Toronto, those can be traded. You've got a better liquidity in those than you have in your favorite junior stock that's sitting there dead. And if you take a look at, say, just GDXJ, over the last year, there's some very good trades in there, up or down. And you don't want to throw your whole wad at it, but, you know, if you do a trade and a couple of weeks later it can cover, either long or short, it soon adds up. to making a little money. And that's the way to do it, to doing a few trades. So there we are.
Very good. Well, Bob, why don't you tell folks more about Institutional Advisors, please?
Yeah, well, we've been in the business of doing research on equities, on metals, on all commodities, currencies, and for a long time, and have put together some models that work for us. And you can get into the website, institutionaladvisors.com, go on for introductory basis for maybe 4 or 5 weeks, and then decide whether you want to take it on a subscription.
Bob Hoy, another excellent installment filled with cuisine for cogitation. We'll look forward to having you back on the show, sir.
Good to be with you, Chris.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.